Okay, our next presenter is Mike Pappas from Orban. He is the Vice President of Business Development for both Orban and De Sequeira, along with owner of Pappas Consulting. As we all know, the world is moving over to the cloud, and this is happening in our business for radio. Our challenges is getting the audio along with your PPM, your pad, your RDS, all this. Our challenges to get to our transmitter sites, and the presentation is going to go over improvements and suggestions of how we can accomplish this. Going to turn it over to Mike.
Well, good morning. Come on, you guys got to do better than that, right? Well, testing 1, 2. You know why we always, audio guys only count to 2? Because on 3 we lift, okay? So, okay, good. So I push this button. Okay, that counterintuitive, but it worked. Let's see, anybody not know who we are? Because then I'm gonna just run through a bunch of slides here real quick, okay? There's been a lot of talk about containers and things. This is a product that we introduced a year ago. It's a Linux-based, runs on a Dell Blade, and there are 8700i's in a 1RU box. Our launch customer started off with 400 channels and is now running 1,000 of them, which is kind of a fun thing. And it's got a unified user interface using Ross Video's dashboard. So the launch customer can look at all 1,000 processing channels with a single login. And we've been shipping that now for a while. That's also cloudable, and we've got 400 channels of cloud AWS running that right now for a customer in Asia. So a long time ago on a planet far, far and away in a different lifetime in another galaxy, we had STLs, and for a zillion years, that all worked really good. Most of us all know what a 950 meg composite STL is. We used that to feed FM stations for a long time. If you were in the AM business, I saw everything from equalized lines to, you name it, feeding AM sites. And in the last couple of years, I've been to a lot of those. When we got to HD radio, things got to be a little more complex because now we had to schlep a bunch of stuff up to a transmitter site. And now if we're really thinking about doing cloud in a big way, then we've got to look at maybe using some different ideas for getting stuff to the transmitter site and dealing with the last mile issue. So today what I'm doing is an idea session. I'm going to throw out a bunch of ideas that we've been talking to various customers about, and see if any of that stuff makes any sort of sense. So we're going to start with a little bit of a question and answer at this point. Let's see a show of hands. How many of you folks have fiber to transmitter sites? Wow, cool. That's very cool. How many of you have reliable 5G coverage to a transmitter site? Pick it. Right, any of them. Do you have any, under the heading of any at all, 5G capability? How many of you guys have fiber and 5G at the same site? One. How many of you guys are feeding remote sites via satellite? How many of you guys have EAS receivers at your transmitter sites? Lots. How many of you guys are encoding PPM? Well, all that stuff enters into the equation of what do we got to schlep out to the transmitter site and how do we get it there? Obviously, if you've got fiber at your site, that's a big leg up in terms of how much data you can shove out to a transmitter site. Sites with fiber are going to be a lot easier than sites without. Sites with 5G are going to be somewhat easier than fiber, but it's a lot more expensive. The telco carriers are pretty proud of that data service, and it tends to get expensive. If you don't have either of those, then you're going to be looking at some other options there. One is potentially Starlink, and we've been playing around with Starlink now for a while. And the other is microwave, or a combination of all those to try to get the reliability up to where you want it. Some other considerations, RDS, obviously, but that's a very low data rate. EAS is another consideration, and a lot of you folks are running EAS locally at the transmitter sites. PPM encoding is just something you've got to take a consideration for, and whether or not you're going to do some local insertion work. So the question always becomes, how much bandwidth do you need at the transmitter site? And the answer is always more, okay? So we have a bunch of customers that are looking at doing analog FM and up to HD4. We've had some discussions with people looking at doing HD5. That kind of changes things on how you want to get there. So are you going to send the HDs as audio, or are you going to do it as PAD, i.e. E2X, right? And do the HD encoding and then schlep that all out to the transmitter site as E2X is an interesting way to do it. Anybody thinking about running AOIP to a transmitter site? Yep. Lossy compressed composite, that's another set of options. And then, of course, you know, dealing with RDS, which is probably almost infinitesimally small amount of data in the whole scheme of things. So in 2009, I was keeping a bunch of radio stations on the air in Denver, and we had a translator in Breckenridge that we needed to feed. And so the question became, how do we get from Denver to Breckenridge? A microwave shot was kind of out of the question because it would have to traverse the Continental Divide. And that meant that it was going to be inaccessible for about 6 months out of the year. There were a couple of TV guys that had done that, and they didn't have any hair left at the end of that session. So we decided that microwave wasn't going to work. I looked at doing a T1 circuit, but it would have to traverse three carriers, and that was going to be a disaster. Anybody who's ever dealt with telcos knows that when you have multiple carriers involved, they do the A blames B, who blames C, who comes back around to blame A again. So that was not a particularly satisfactory solution, and it was very expensive. Additionally, we also needed to feed a full power station in Vail, and that location that we were at had zip for connectivity. And of course, we wanted to do FM along with three HDs. So we made the executive decision that we were going to ship E2X, and we were going to do it on a C-band satellite channel. The reason we picked C-band was because weather was a factor, and KU wasn't going to be reliable when you have 3 feet of snow in the dish. So what we did was we sent E2X out to those sites, and we recovered the analog FM off the HD1 and used that to run the analog. And it was cheaper in the long run and more reliable than using T1 circuits, and that was back in 2009. And here's a block diagram of that system. I'm going to take a quick drink of water here. So it was relatively complex, but it had full error correction. And so what the downlink, at the uplink, we downlinked the signal. And we compared the packets that we sent up with the ones that came back down. And when we had a packet loss, the system would automatically retransmit that packet. And we had enough buffering at the far end so that we could take the 8 seconds of packet and compensate for it. The system worked really well. And we were running a 60 dB gain uplink antenna with a 10 watt buck. And one day we had a microburst over the station. And we were under automatic power control. And the buck went to full power So we put 10 watts into a 60 dB gain antenna, and we didn't cut through the microburst. So we were running 10 million watts of ERP and didn't make the satellite. But that was the only time it didn't work. And the good news was, I don't think anything was flying in front of the dish when we were doing that. I was kind of expecting to come out there and find, you know, pigeons nicely roasted laying in front of the dish. But no such luck. But we got this whole thing. We got analog FM and three HDs and a 192 kilobit per second satellite channel. And that was cost effective, and it made sense, and it was reliable. A little complex, but it worked. Nowadays, we've got a lot better solutions that are probably even more cost effective and a lot more fun to implement. So as part of this, you've got to think about what you're going to get to the site and what kind of format you're going to get it to the site in. And there's some other things to be involved with, like EAS, RDS, local insertions, and whatever else you want to run there, you know, typically your remote control system and telemetry from the transmitter and things like that. And then, of course, there's the reliability and cost trade-off, right? Because none of this stuff is free, and none of it's going to be cheap. And the question is, how much reliability do you want to bake into this thing at what kind of cost? You know, with fiber, we always have the backhoe problem, right? You know, call before you dig. That seems to be lost on a lot of people who own digging implements. You know, if you do 5G as your primary, A, it's expensive. B, it's not 100% reliable. The company called KDDI in Japan had a failure and put 40 million subscribers off the air for 2 days. Okay? Rogers up in Canada in the last 15 months has had two failures that have put 10 million of their customers off the air. So it's not infallible. Starlink is kind of an interesting thing. We've been playing with one. We've gotten some feedback from customers going, well, it'll never take falling ice off the tower. And so I reached out to Rockwest Composites. And Rockwest Composites builds all the fairings for SpaceX. And I said, can you guys build us a radome for Starlinks? And they were like, absolutely. And I said, I want to be able to drop a 1-inch ball of ice off from a 1,000-foot tower onto the radome and have it survive. And they were like, that's a walk in the park for us. So there are some trade-offs there. They want to only do that with the commercial version because they need the extra margin. Radomes aren't free at the frequencies that Starlink uses in terms of loss. And so they're looking at it and saying, yeah, we can do that with the business version. The business version, Starlink antenna is bigger and it's got a bigger margin. I've been running one at the house now for about 3 or 4 months, running 10 meg of download off from it continuously. And it's about 4 or 5 nines reliable, which is not bad considering. And so here's some just ideas that we were throwing around in terms of block diagrams. And the idea was to use something like a cradle point and then fiber as your wide, as your WAN, and then use the modem, the cellular modems as backup. And we've been playing around with that idea, and that works. And depending upon how industrial you want to get, IBR 1100 has got two modems in it. You can go all the way up to a Cisco, which has got, can support four modems in it and two different ports. The Cisco gear is nice, but expensive. It'll also do site-to-site VPN on board, which is kind of fun. But these are just some ideas that we've been tossing around and playing with that are probably worth exploring. speeds. After spending a dozen years out in the country with 6 meg DSL, we were able to finally get fiber. And I have to tell you, I was like a 12-year-old on Christmas morning with a flamethrower when they hooked that up. Man, I was like, I can upload the world here. And my fiber at the house gets me about 913 down and about 809 up with about a 17 millisecond ping. Starlink Consumer, which is what I'm currently running on the roof of the house, reliably gets me 20 meg down and about 2.5 up. And then Verizon on LTE with one bar gets me 10 meg down and a meg up. And I could improve that if I had better signal strength and wasn't out in the middle of nowhere. But those are just kind of some ideas in terms of throughput. One of the issues with dealing with cellular LTE 5G is management of carriers. And, you know, if you've got 20 sites, and based on what you've got coverage, you might have, you know, 5 or 6 different carriers involved. The question is, how do you manage that stuff? And how do you change carriers because if somebody else has a better plan? There's a company called Core Wireless that can do all that kind of work. There are a couple of folks here that are actually running Core Wireless, so they can provide a convenient interface to all of your stuff out in the field and can remotely change your carriers. And they can provide you with hard IP addresses protected by a firewall that are carrier agnostic. So if you change carriers, you're not sitting there going, what's the new IP address at that location? DNAV can do that kind of work also. There's some other people in that business. So that the carrier choice doesn't become overhead that you don't want to deal with. This is an IBR 1100 that I drive around with in my 2001 Ford Excursion. And it's set up so that when it's parked near the house, it automatically logs into the Wi-Fi network. And when it's driving down the road, it's doing LTE. I've only got a single carrier in it, which is Verizon, because where I end up going, Verizon's the primary carrier for it. I could slap another SIM card into it and do AT&T if I wanted to. I just didn't really need the extra redundancy of it. But I was able to program that myself, and considering I'm relatively weak in the IT department area, you know, there was a YouTube video and it was like, here, do this, and it worked. So, you know, most of my education these days, YouTube. So public internet, InfoSec and management, you know, none of this stuff, there's always some level of exposure here. If you want to manage latency and redundancy, APT SureStream, which has always-on redundancy, dual path, is out there for you to do that with. If you're going to do that with a backup on cellular, that's going to be expensive. So it's something to consider is how much data are you going to schlep on the carrier networks, and what's that going to cost you? Security is an issue. You know, we're big fans of hardware VPN set up site to site, kind of works good. And management, you know, we try to, on AOIP networks, all of our AOIP gear has a separate management port. We don't want to do management down on the same networks that you're running AOIP. And that was something that was drilled into us early on by a whole bunch of really bright InfoSec people who were like, we're not putting any of these systems together unless you have separate management ports. Okay, it's easy. AT&T has a service called FirstNet, which is dedicated for first public safety and first responders. And I've asked the NAB to see if they can reach out to AT&T and get broadcasters qualified as first responders or critical infrastructure, considering that during some sort of disaster or event, the public typically dials up radio to get their information. I think it's a kind of a no-brainer. So David Layer at the NAB is working that problem, and if you guys and gals can reach out to David Layer if you're interested in getting on FirstNet. The advantage of FirstNet is it's a dedicated Band 14 cellular network. There's nothing else on it except public safety and first responders. It's a hardened network. Verizon offers a similar program with prioritized data and access. And it's significantly more cost-effective because public safety is public safety. So if the NAB can convince AT&T to make broadcasters public safety qualified for FirstNet, that would give you guys a really great option for a carrier that's really dedicated to high reliability and survivability in disasters. Reduced bandwidth. Yes, you can get stuff down to very low bandwidth. There's always a trade-off. Nothing in life is free. There's a couple of ways to do it. You can do UMPX or APT-MPX. If you're going to do that, you have to be careful with PPM encoding. So if you really get below 500 kilobits per second, there's a potential you could impact your PPM encoding. Lossy compressed audio. So let's process in the cloud, and then let's send it down something like, I don't know, pick it, AAC plus, right? First off, virtually all the codecs out there do not enjoy 75 microsecond preemphasis, and Bob Orban will happily write a giant paper on why they don't like 75 microsecond preemphasis. But that's something you got to consider. You don't want to use lossy codecs. You don't want to do 75 microsecond preemphasis and lossy codecs. It's just not going to be good. Additionally, there's going to be issues with peak control at the end of that cycle. Bob says it can be upwards of a dB or so of peak control problems. And all that's going to have to be fixed at the transmitter site. And then you've got to figure out how you're going to turn that into something that can drive a transmitter. So all those things just need to be considered, and if you're going to really do the whole cloud thing. And we do processing in the cloud. But right now, that processing is being done for streaming, and we aren't processing in the cloud and sending 75 microsecond preemphasis audio down to a transmitter site. We have people asking for it. This is a block diagram that we put together for a potential customer. It's using Starlink as a primary. It's using Core Wireless 5G as the backup backhaul. That's using a Cisco router to make that all work and to set up the VPN, site-to-site VPN. We've built a test system up. It works. If you need something like that, come and see us. We'd love to talk to you about it. We're looking for some potential guinea pigs. And you know what guinea pigs always say? Feed me. So if you're up for that kind of an adventure, we'd certainly love to talk to you about it. We've got a demo in the ballroom next door. The DNAV guys are running an audio stream on a cradle point. It's being fed with a sports talk station that they here in Madison, and we're also feeding that audio over to the ENCO booth to demonstrate their in-caption, closed caption system for radio. And I'll be hanging out there if you want some more information. Let's see what else. Those are kind of the fun parts. Questions? Did I put you guys all to sleep today? Guys and gals all to sleep today? Come on, you guys. This group is not caffeinated sufficiently. Yes. Oh, we have people. Yeah, Shane, yes, please, because the mic is coming over to you.
Hi, Mike.
Good morning, Shane.
I promise I'm not going to surprise you with anything here. You talked a little bit about getting MPX out of your the rack unit that you've got, the 8 rack unit.
Yes, so we have these things called endpoints, and our endpoints will will generate, so you can feed an endpoint with AOIP, and it will generate standard analog composite, DMPX. It's got an AES output. It will also take an external RDS generator if you aren't planning on using one of ours. You can also hit it with an AES digital input from your EAS box and a contact closure, and it will automatically switch from whatever its nominal source is to your EAS box when it's given a closure for an EAS alert. Those boxes we'll have in production Q1 next year. We have some prototypes that'll be available for you guys to look at in about 30 days. So if you want to play with one, come and see me and I'll send it to you. I know, well, and you've got an enterprise XPN. Yes, well, we are working diligently on that. And it's based on the Orban Next Generation Platform, or ONP, and it's got a bunch of really great little features in it. And because it's virtually software-defined, we're not tied into, it's got to be done this way. So we're really looking for feedback from potential customers saying, you know, we want this left-handed widget. And one of the other things is that we've had people ask for not only an EAS input, but a local insertion input. And if you look at that drawing there, you'll also see we've got one of our AES nodes, which, by the way, we're delivering, which can do all that stuff too.
Yeah, so that's exactly what I was looking for. And you and I have talked about this, is basically an endpoint where you can do that EAS insertion and the local content insertion. Because, I mean, we run a large network and all satellite delivery, but all the EAS and all the local spots are inserted at the transmitter site. So.
Well, and you know, when we started looking at this, it was a couple of years ago, and I looked at, you know, how you guys did this kind of thing, and a bunch of other customers who've got 60 or 70 sites, and you know, the whole kludge of stuff that has to go on there, and you got to get this down to the point where it makes some sort of rational sense, and you can send somebody in there to fix it without them needing, you know, an IT degree to make it work. So, question.
All this is well and good, but what I have to do, and I'm intrigued by this, okay? How do I go back to my manager at my radio station, my part owner, my managing partner, and explain to him how this system, what you propose, is going to help improve his bottom line, other than through improvement of the listener experience, which is what we're all aimed at here. So I need to talk to somebody at the booth. I think that several others of us would probably have the same question. What do you do to sell your management on this concept? Especially considering what he's had to go through with regard to failures of his internet, 5G, et cetera. This is a problem.
Well, and that's a really good set of questions. And I don't know if I have any really great answers in that kind of situation. You know, I'm not going to come up here and tell you that this is the be-all, end-all for every station in the planet. It's not. And there's a lot of environments where, you know, if you're not running HD, a 950 meg composite STL with a processor at the studio is probably, a really good, appropriate solution. You know, we ran one for a long time before we did HD radio, and then the minute we did HD, the world stopped. And then, we end up with a whole different set of problems. You know, I was going to put an 18 gig microwave link from the studio to the transmitter site, right? This was great. Telco hardware, got lots of bandwidth, the whole nine yards, right? And then Buckley Air Force Base was in our sphere of where we were going to operate this thing, and they put the whole kibosh on it because they're doing something with 18 gig out there, and they won't tell anybody about it. And the FCC bounced our app. Okay, I mean, all this stuff comes into play. So we ended up at 11 gig with an STA, and then anyway. But you're right. And these are engineered solutions, right? Somebody like Shane comes to us and says, here's what we've got to do. Here's our sets of problems. What do you have for a solution? It's not off the shelf. It's not one size fits all. And you've got to have a use case that makes some sort of rational sense. Go ahead.
So in my situation, what we're starting to do now is we have one site that's becoming our operations center, kind of like what Shane's doing. We have, I think, a total of 45 transmitters. And right now we're feeding the kind of pre-processed audio over IP links to the various sites, which have their own processing and local insert points with nodes and things like that. So if I'm following you correctly, would the XPN box for the multiple stations be at the studio side, and then there's a second box that generates MPX and can take in local? Well, I guess that would be a little bit difficult with the processing back at the original site, but the ability to process at one point and break it out at another.
The diagram that's on the screen does that. So the processing is done at the studio, and then at the transmitter site, it's recovered, converted into composite, and local insertions and local EAS are done at that location. So yes, we can do all that stuff very shortly. And that box is, I mean, literally in production. The prototype, 50 units are being built right now. So, and it does all that stuff because, you know, at one point or another, I was doing all that stuff out in the field, and I had to have local EAS insertion and veil, and, you know, just all that stuff. And so given an opportunity to come up with a way to solve that problem, I was like, okay, here's what we got to get done. And then I bounced it off some of our potential customers who came back with, we need, besides EAS, we want another input here. And by the way, with the AES node, one of our customers came to us and said, you know, when we do an EAS alert, can we have the AES node send us an AOIP stream back to the home office that we can record this so that we know that we've sent the EAS alert? And I was like, yeah, that's brilliant. We can write a script in ROS dashboard, because all this stuff is run by ROS Video's dashboard. You can write a script that says, when that contact closure hits, I'm going to route that audio to the node that's going to put it in the transmitter, and I'm going to send another stream back to master control, and we're going to record it so that we know that we've shipped the EAS alert. And I was like, brilliant, we can do that. So we've tried to make the system extremely flexible and relatively easy to use. But it's an engineered solution. It's not just buy a box and plug it in. It's a very different thing. But you know, with 45 stations, you and I need to have a chat. So any other questions? Well, you folks have been a great audience today. I really appreciate your time. And thank you all very much.